Blog Talk Radio.
What up, everybody? Happy New Year. I think it's the last day you can say that. It's the 7th, so it's the, I think it's the first week where you can still say Happy New Year and people won't look at you like you three carat crazy, but that's where we are. Just wanted to bring it in right. God willing, the creek don't rise. We won't have issues like we had last week. That was horrible, but we will move on. Sister Vashi, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. Happy your new year, not quite mine.
Okay.
I don't celebrate the new year when you do.
Okay, so when do you celebrate the new year, sis?
The new year is, in general, for me, the first day of spring.
When it's warm and you can go outside.
When it begins again, right? When life begins again.
Right. Right, I got you. I can dig that.
Right around just before, you know, there's spring, when we get back to where it's, you know, equal day, equal night, or something like that. Not equal, that's summertime. When we get back to things being coming out of the permanent frost, animals come out of hibernation, and babies are, you know, being born from everybody hunkering down. Spring is the new year. This is the beginning of the fiscal, you know, this is some fiscal economic stuff, you know, but it's contra to the idea of things being new. Nothing is born cold. I mean, everything that's really cold goes into what they call scientifically stasis. And, you know, that just means it just gets as close to its basic biochemical mechanism that it hunkers down as low as it can. It, in tree terms, it sheds its leaves and redirects the resources to, you know, the trunk and root. You know what I'm saying? So
I got you.
When you get ready to talk new, you don't think the dead of winter. You should be thinking when things look new, when things are new, when new shit is popping. And it's just not what you know. The only thing new happening is whatever weird is going on with the Republicans right now.
They did not want him. Yo, I'm an ugly dude. So I understand what it feels like to not go to the dance or be asked out and be taken seriously when you approach somebody, you know what I'm saying? So Kevin McCarthy is that dude. Like, he's the ugly duckling in school. He's the cat in the lunchroom, the cafeteria, that was sitting by himself, and then somebody, you know, felt sorry for him and was like, yo, you can sort of kind of hang with us, you know, but you got to be, like, in the back. You know what I'm saying? Like, if we walk in, you can walk too, like, on the same side of the street, but be, like, six paces behind us so, you know, we can still be cool, you know what I mean? But you're close enough to be in our orbit, but we don't want you being attracted by our graviton waves to get close to actually the surface. So, nah, dog. And he just kept going and begging and pleading and selling and giving and taking and, you know, taking a beating, that is. You know, I think Representative Gates was like, yo, I don't even know what more to ask for this dude because I've gotten everything. Like, how do you do that? How do you get promises from a dude to literally give you everything you freaking wanted? And this dude has absolute no power. But as soon as he comes into power, he will have absolutely no daggone power. It took 13 votes for him to cross over? 13. Yo, that's horrible. That is so sad. And there were folks at the last minute that still could not vote for this cat. The not presence still could not vote for him.
Because people looked up and saw their check couldn't clear. See, at the base of this, somebody looked up and they realized, hold up, did y'all read Clause 13 in Article 1 back on page 537? It said whoever this motherfucker is the one who cleared a budget to stamp your check.
Mm.
And they was like, oh, that's right. It's been so long, we forgot that shit.
Mm.
My apologies, I was off.
It wasn't 13 votes. It was 14. He won on the 15th. So I apologize. I was off. My bad. I'm getting fact-checked over here. But, yeah, he won on the 15th vote. Yo, that is so just totally disrespectful. So, how do you win the majority? Can't carry a leader to the gavel on the first vote. Okay. Let's say not even the first vote. Let's be gracious. It wasn't, because, you know, some people may have some feelings. Like, okay, the third. By the third, you couldn't reconcile and iron out your differences. It took 14 no's to get to the 15th to get a yay. Oh my God, this dude looked poor. He looked pitiful. He looked like, I don't know if sneakers were banging in Kansas City, but I remember when I'm going to keep it simple. I'm going to say when Deidre is hit, they were like you know what? I'm gonna make it even better than that. I'm going to take it to, like, 87. 87 when the suede Pumas hit. And everybody had the toothbrush in their back pocket in order to swipe them joints off and keep them clean. If he looked like the kid that came back to school after Christmas break with some bubble-toe Nikes or some Jaffa Cell, some Asics from Payless, that's what he looked. He looked like everybody got
this
stuff.
Out of touch is what he's saying. Out of touch with the zeitgeist of his time. But
yo,
look at that hustle,
horrible.
Though. who's on his team? Who is his who is his rallying people? Because he got some. What was that show Kevin Spacey was in? House of Cards. He's House of Cards because whatever these, you know, finanglings are happening and these misogynations and machinations is working aim in these back rooms. It finally got him in, you know, the seat that he's been seeking. And it wasn't just him saying, you know, he had to have a consortium of people willing to wheel and deal on his behalf because, as you just mentioned, he was essentially powerless, you know. So they realized
My question is, as a group. Mm-hmm.
That something had to happen in order for even their own personal best interest to you know, manifest itself. So they can work together.
Was it the elected or was it the donors? Was it the donors that called up and was like, look, dog, at this point, it's embarrassing. He has the majority of the votes. Rock it through, let it be, or I'm going to have to cut my money. Seriously, because, again, if he gave the entire House, he gave them everything. He gave anybody and anybody that objected to his speakership whatever they wanted. So if he gave that all and still couldn't cross the finish line, who and or what was left? Who and or what was left? You had a serious challenge from Jeffrey, a serious challenge from the Democrats. The Democrats were not in control. Yes, there's a slim margin. There's a very slim margin in the House. But the Democrats are not in control. And this dude was nipping at his heels on every vote. On every vote he was nipping at his heels. That is a problem. That is a problem not only for them, but that's a problem for the country. Because when it gets to real policy, when it gets to real procedures, how is this thing going to break? Because you truly put ourselves as a country in a position where, honestly, two or three, four disgruntled Congress people can say no and stop the entire works. They can stop the entire works of the United States government. Three or four, it doesn't take many. Because the margin is so thin of the division between the House Republicans and the House Democrats. Because it is so razor thin, three or four of them could be like, yeah, I don't want to do that. And it's done. It will never go anywhere. It's a total stalemate. Because the Democrats have shown, at least here, that they will march as a bloc. Hell, they look like the daggone Republicans. The Democrats look like the daggone Republicans. None of them broke party and went with somebody else. All of them stayed with party and went for Jeffrey. Every last one of them. That was impressive because that is something the Democrats do not do. They have been horrible at that. That is definitely a Republican tactic. The Republicans led the Democrats. Over the past week, the Republicans led. I didn't know who the hell. I thought I was in Bizarro Land. I promise you. I had no clue as to what I was watching on C-SPAN. I really thought I got bumped on the head and tunneled in a bizarro world because they did. They looked like the daggone Democrats. That's the Democratic crap that they just pulled. And the Democrats stood firm looking like the daggone Republicans. But, hey, he crossed the line. Now let's see what he's going to do with the gavel because there's some real challenges going on. Immigration is still an issue. You know, infrastructure, the bill passed, it's being funded. Rodney has pointed out that, you know, we should see real results on that. Toward the end of Q1, specifically, though, into Q2 or at the end of Q2. So we're talking another 4 or 5 months. We'll start seeing job reports, and I think the consumer index will look even better. Consumer confidence and spending will look even better. But still, this housing bubble is a problem. It's a problem. And Is it going to burst? Is it going to flatten out? Is someone going to step in and be like, okay, look, we need another look or fresh look at valuation of homes and valuation of borrowers, to be honest with you. And we may need to standardize that. Someone going to do that? Is Elon Musk going to lose another $2 billion?
How do you foresee this kind of playing out? Is there eventually becoming, much like we have to redo the infrastructure, there's going to be some type of anti-blight initiative coupled with a workforce building, you know, like a carpentry, what do they call them people? Construction workers, that kind of carpentry type, hands-on tradesmen type of reenlistment. They're going to, because we don't, all those builders, they're dying. They're dead. Some of them, you know, the builders of America are like 70 years old. I mean, we got some young dudes popping, you know what I'm saying? They can put up an apartment building or two. But the true builders, those was an older generation. And when codes and stuff shifted and they realized they had been left to work with materials that were killing them and stuff, the relationship between the working man and America changed. And so there's going to have to be a rebuilding a trust, in my opinion, between the carpenter, between the even the railroad guy. Because they compensate them, but when you tell them, oh, no, we're not going to pay out them, you know, whatever denial they just got in the railroad industry, they're not going to be able to get trusty tracksmen, you know, people who maintain the road, that people who are ready to sign up to become into America's Department of Transportation down at the tradesman's level. You understand what I'm saying, Lee? That relationship is getting more and more fragmented. And so they're going to have to lure my son, who's 15, in. You hear me? They're going to have to give him a lure him in with an agricultural a scholarship, I guess now they would call it a material science scholarship. I don't know. A civil engineering scholarship. They're going to have to lure my son in with these lower-level trades, you know, so that they can build the clientele that they, you know, the personnel that they need to even put some of this shit he's dangling in front of us in place because, you know, if you go on to any major construction site and ask these GPs and you ask these foremen, what's the deal? And they'll tell you. That the American tradesman is not what he was in 1920. Hell, fuck that. In 1900. And, you know, and these were men who were fed less, but had latched on to this nation in a way where we just don't care. I don't think we hold it as dear as they did. And so we're ready to be paid because we saw what those robber barons got. We studied in school about J.P. Morgan and Chase and Rockefeller and all these railroad barons. And now we still get to see little bitty-ass Warren Buffett with his little Chester grin in our face. And so we seeing these even modern-day robber barons, and it's painful to see Grandpa die with asbestos lung, and them in there talking about, oh, but he smoked. Fuck yeah, he smoked. He smoked because he put up 200,000 fucking roofs all over Chicago, you know? And y'all didn't tell him he was digging out asbestos.
Well, I say this to you. I find one hole in your theory. The builders of America aren't old. The builders of America are Latino, and they stuck at the damn border. So we got to really talk about immigration as far as that's concerned, because those are the builders of America at this point. Let's be real. You go to a daggone construction site, you go to a roadworks project, there are more daggone Latinos out there than any daggone body. You know what I'm saying? That was a redneck job. That was a country boy job. It was a brother. I'm in the projects 2 days ago. I went out to the projects that I grew up at because, you know, they got the good chicken out there. So I went out there, got me some chicken, and I'm cruising through the hood. I always cruise through the hood, you know what I'm saying, see if I can see anybody outside, blah, 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 blah. Two things I saw. The first thing I saw was there were homes being boarded up. I've never seen that. So to me, that's like, okay, it's really happening. What I mean by that is there's been a plan to get rid of my community that I grew up in for years, and it never was executed. You're starting to board up homes in the project. That is the telltale sign that they're not moving new people in, and they're trying to shut it down. So that was the first thing I saw. The second thing I saw when I got up to the hill was a working crew. Now, that crew, again, when I was younger, was mostly brothers. Mostly brothers. That crew was all Latino yesterday. I'm sorry, 2 days ago, Wednesday. They were all, 3 days, I'm sorry, it's Saturday, whatever. Wednesday, they were all Latino. Every last one of them. And I was like, wow. Never seen that. Never, ever, ever had I seen that. But again, that's the change that's going on. And that's real, man.
Well, I grew up in Southern California, so I've seen all Latino everything. I've seen an almost all Latino school. We got one here in Kansas City where I think 98.8, even the lunch lady is Hispanic. So,
okay.
What you need to know, though, is that these are subcontracting issues as well. What they're finding is when you get a big company, right, you want to do something major, you get a big company. That company is associated with some smaller companies. And those smaller companies are associated with even smaller companies. Now, when you get down to that last tier, which is what you said, Pedro and all the rest, they all put in bids. Everybody's putting in a bid. They put in a bid to them, and it goes all the way up to the top. They collect all the bids, and then they put some frosting on it, and then they submit it. When you get ready to actually do the work, they beat and lied about how many people were actually available to do the work. This industry is – so they have to. They have to outsource to people. Now, what they do is they leave them to get their own dudes. They don't vet every single one. When you keep subcontracting like that all the way to the end, they can't vet all the way down to the man who scraped the concrete straight. They leave it up to some dude, and he's got to be a legitimate dude. Now, so when you say that our guys, our builders are stuck at the border, you are not lying, Lee. But, you know, but it's not still right. It's not fair. Because that means we're going to defunct the trades industry in this nation. We're going to live not of money, but of a brain trust. We're going to defunct it of the ability to push it forward using any kind of American ingenuity, because they're not going to bring their best. They're just going to do whatever the bare minimum of what it is they're allowed to do on these jobs. And I think, you know, I'm not trying to be funny. If we do not start at the ground trades level, whatever we build, it's not going to be right. We already seeing some of the effects of some of the poor labor we got in the 60s and 70s. Them bridges
are
is crumbling,
Lee.
Bridges
and the roads? Yeah, the bridges.
Man,
the
hey, man, them bridges has got bones. Our bridges and shit got Joe Biden's bones.
I don't think that that was poor craftsmanship. I think it was piss poor planning, and then the lack of proper maintenance. Piss poor planning because I believe that most cities thought that mass transit was going to be a viable solution. I don't think that they believed that the car would ever be as effective as it actually became, and or as cheap as it got down to. So I read an article a couple months back. Did you know that Cincinnati, Ohio has, I believe, the largest, if not the second largest, subway in the United States of America? Did you know that?
Not New York?
Cincinnati. Did you know that they've never used it? They never used it. They built a subway system in the city of Cincinnati and never used it. So benches, portraits, everything are still in these subway stations and have never been used. The only thing that's on them is dust. That's it. They never used the freaking subway system. They did not
Did they say anything about why?
Track. I can't remember. But it blew my mind that they even had a subway, because I never knew Cincinnati had a subway. They never used it. Never used it. More than likely it was, you know, somebody had some money and was like, yo, I invested in cars and y'all gonna kill me if you go with this damn subway idea. You know what I'm saying? So shut it down or I'm gonna shut my money off to you. You know what I mean? But yeah, more than likely that's what happened. And I, you know, that's worth talking about. So I'll dig into it again. I just remember reading the article and I was taken aback because, again, I never knew they had a damn subway. Never knew. I would never have thought that. But again, they never used it. All the stations are there. I mean, they could get that thing up and running tomorrow if they wanted to. Everything's there. It's literally is all there.
But this is what I want to know. Why don't we have people in the Department of Transportation who rally and beat that beast back just like the Department of Defense does? Why wouldn't the Department of Defense, knowing they got more money than they even asked for, find some kind of partnership with the Department of Transportation? Because some of the wear and tear coming from military personnel, military transport. Why is there no reach over? Why is there no, or, you know, I want to say reach around, but that has negative connotations in the mail. why is there no symbiosis? Why is there no, you know, I just don't understand when they all dipping from one quaffer of money. Because all of it is money that you got from the people, whether it be donors or lobbyists. Or whether it be taxes from the actual, you know, that you took out of my damn paycheck, man. So why is there no, and why don't we have just a dude to say, I want to know how many people the Department of Health and Public Safety, how many other groups have you talked to? Have you been able to talk to the Department of Transportation to see what you can do to reduce, you know, how many more rest stops you can put up for those who just happen to have a stroke or a heart attack while they're in transport, or more medical facilities closer to the some kind of clinic or something at these rest stops, or some type of medical personnel at the rest stops? Because more, you know, I know at some point people come into a rest stop needing medical attention. Why don't you guys coordinate with what's happening with people on the road and figure out a way and we can get some of this money and, you know, and cover some of these faces instead of acting like, no, nobody's there to do that. There is nobody. Right. And I'm like, that's what it dissuades me from believing in the actual effectiveness of politics. But like you said, that's above my head.
Rashi, you're asking fat cats to stop getting fat. You're asking people to turn around and pay attention where the food is coming from when all they want is to eat more and more and more because it makes them bigger. And the bigger they are, the more crap they get for free, the more they feel good about themselves. And for the ones that are actually helping people, the bigger they are, the more people they can help. But for the most of them, the majority of them, the fatter they are, the better it is for them. You know what I'm saying? Again, as I said earlier about the Democrats looking like the Republicans, the Republicans looking like Democrats, the Republicans will fall on the sword for one another. Why? Because they understand that if you take this L for us to get whatever we want to get through, we're going to give you a fellowship. We'll give you a partnership. We'll put you on a board. We'll make sure you still get your money. That's how they act. That's how they move. It's not a loss. You know, you said, oh, for such and such was defeated. Oh, he got his butt whipped. That joke was laughing the whole day on time. I'm like, shh, I start my new gig on Monday. I got
that
a four-day
vacation. That's that house of cards, kid Lee. It makes the people feel like you can do all your mechanism. You can go, you can vote, you can even inform yourself, but there's just these calls that are being made. I always go back to my boy David Axelrod because he's the kind of person I'm talking about, where they have access to these other people. They have access to these consortiums and these groups of headhunters and think tanks and blah, 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 these, and statisticians. Oh, Lee, you want to get your money popping? Do some, you know, be somebody who runs statistical, you know, survey analysis on the opinion of this and that when it comes to political matters. That's who these, you know, movers and shakers are using in order to, you know, enact some of this social, I call it social evil. You just call it political maneuvering. We got our differences of opinion. We got our differences of opinion. Because I actually know what that shakes down to. What it shakes down to the grassroots level is somewhere in some immigration, legal aid immigration office, there's four overwhelmed public, you know, lawyers trying to handle hundreds and thousands of different cases, right? And if people really cared, they would have at least 20 more employees and govern a federal, you know, and another federal network so that they can go through where they were not being, bottlenecked, intentionally bottlenecked so that they don't have to deal with this oncoming problem, what you said earlier. All those people who we need, they're at the border waiting on us, you know.
Brother Rodney's on. Good morning, Rodney. Rodney, woo.
Good morning, brother. As usual, you got me up out of the bed, brother. Can't not able to sleep in. You know, first Saturday of the new year. Here it is. I am with you all, but that's okay because you're some of the best people that if I have to get up to be with. Hey. Happy New Year to you, to Sister Rashi, to all the listeners. And I was listening in. Doc has been on for a minute. He's been listening in. And Rashi asked a question, and I'm not sure whether it was rhetorical or not, but I did want to give a response because I do hear questions like this often. And it was, why doesn't the military use their money to do to provide transportation or support transportation? And I just want to share with everyone that the money does, even though the money comes from the taxpayers, once it goes to Congress, the taxpayers set up different pots of money, or sometimes we call them buckets of money. And once that money has been put into that bucket, that's what it has to be
once
spent.
It's allocated.
So when it gets put into the military bucket, it has to be spent on military stuff. And sometimes Congress sets it up so that the military buys things that the military doesn't necessarily want. But because Congress says you have to do it, you know, they follow the orders of Congress. And Congress has overall dominion over the military. So Congress is the one that declares wars. Congress is the one that controls the purse. The president controls the rhetoric. And once the money is allocated, then the president controls the federal government. So separation of powers is at work here. Not to say that it always works perfectly, but once money has been allocated for the military, they have to spend it on the military. When it's been allocated to the Department of Transportation, it has to be spent on the Department of Transportation. The Department of Transportation cannot suddenly decide on its own that they're going to take money that was designated for it and spend it on the SNAP program, because if it was not allocated for that, it cannot be spent on that.
Right, and here's the other side of it. This is the part that I think most people outside of the government don't understand. The federal government is not set up like your household. It is not set up to save money. It's not. Because if you don't spend that money this year, because you were able to save, you know what I'm saying, you didn't have an expenditure you thought you were going to have, or the expenditure you thought you were going to have wasn't as much as you projected, and let's just say you saved $10 billion. You have a $10 billion windfall. Guess what happens next year? You don't get that money back. You don't. So if you ask for $90 billion this year, you save $10 billion, right? It's like, oh, hey, put that back. We can use that someplace else. Yeah, guess what? Next year, you're only getting $80 billion, if not less. Well, you made it through last year without it. You make it through this year without it. But again, if that expenditure that you guesstimated came in under, if it wasn't necessarily whatever, guess what? If you're in August, September, and you still have that money, your higher ups are telling you, spend, 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 spend. Because if you don't, we ain't getting it next year. And you can buy whatever the Hades you want to buy. They don't care as long as you spend it. Sad but true. Sad but true.
Well, that is correct. But I just wanted to put emphasis for Sister Rashi that it's not that the military doesn't care. It's not their job specifically to look at transportation unless it specifically affects the military. But the government's money goes into buckets for the specific departments that it's allocated for. And even once it's allocated to those departments, even sometimes that money has to be spent on that particular thing. So if money is allocated to F-16, you're not able to, even within the military, you're not able to suddenly turn that money over to tanks. Or if money is spent to bullets, you know, you're not necessarily able to shift that money over to airplanes and vice versa. So it's not that the military doesn't want to, but I will say, one, that's not the military's function, but two, Congress is the one who determines the expenditures of those tax dollars. Once it goes to the government, it's many pots. It's not one pot.
Yeah. But I just think it seems – you don't see how if we could integrate some of these departments, we could actually not only properly cover some of the issues that are happening, but we can use one department as a check balance for the other. I mean, if we're having, like I said earlier, you know, issues with the agricultural issues with the food, and then again, we having problems executing the SNAP program. If there is no food, you can't execute the SNAP program. So, public health and safety needs to be in a partnership with the agricultural program just to make sure that it just seems reasonable to me that there be reach over into other departments, because in actuality, it doesn't, in real life, one absolutely affects the other, you know? And so I just wanted to know how, you know, what is it about those budgetary constraints that makes it so hard to get, you know, to get bureaucracy, to push bureaucracy back.
Let me get back in so we can wrap this up and get Doc in. So, again, as I said a couple minutes ago, the federal government is not set up like a household. It is not set up to save money. It is literally set up to spend money. So if you're thinking about it from the sense of, well, this makes sense, you're thinking about it wrong, because that's not how it's set up. Not. The bureaucracy is the bureaucracy, and the bureaucracy is why it's set up the way it's set up. To push back against that means that you're taking money out of certain cats' hands. All of this contract, yo, it is not $75 for a toilet seat. It's not. Somebody's getting a kickback. So that contract is directed to this company. That company has a liaison that kicks back to the congressperson that either wrote the legislation or hacked off them. That's how it works, man. That is what our country has boiled down to, and that's how it's working. And let's bow that for a second, because we got Dr. Bradshaw on, and I wanted to – been waiting to have him on, because first off, morning.
Morning.
There's so many questions I have for you. I promise you there's so many questions I have for you. But let's talk about your concentration. I deal with young black men a lot. I'm a manager by trade. My goal, especially at this part in my life and my career, is to help as many young folks, black, brown, different, to be successful. To teach them that the way this game works in these streets is business first, your thoughts, your feelings separate. Because your feelings about something have absolutely nothing to do with the business sense in the thing. So
okay.
as I deal with folks, especially younger folks, I have noticed that they are extremely emotionally driven, and I wonder how or what impact the breakdown of our familiar family structure has had on. Can you speak to that?
Okay, I don't want you to think that I wasn't paying attention. I was listening very closely. So we're trying to connect the young men that you have in front of you to
just
the breakdown of the family structure.
No, just young men in general being emotionally based, emotionally driven. They're very emotionally driven. I've noticed this in a lot of young men. And I would like to talk about that and connect it to, if possible, the breakdown of our traditional family structure.
Okay. Can you give me an example of the young men that you work with? So, for example, like age group. Are you guys in a rec center? Do you deal with school? Just give me a little bit more information so I can have a more detailed picture.
Young men, I would say between 28, 35, inner city, and most of them inner city. Most of them have children already. What more do you want from there?
Okay. Actually, it may not seem like it, but that was actually very helpful. So give me half a second here. So with that age group, and you said most of them are also fathers, do they meet regularly with you and the majority of the time all together?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
No. Well, they work for me, so, we see one another regularly.
Okay, but do you meet regularly as a group?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Do they have any other connections with black men outside the group?
Yes.
Okay. So the reason why I brought that up is there's some research that suggests that black males and males of color especially having opportunities to network and gather and to have safe spaces. And so my first thought was when you all meet together, it's a safe space. And what I mean by that, it's more likely to be a place where men would be emotional because they're around other men and they're feeling that that's the one place where they could be, where they can let their hair down, so to speak. So it sounds like that might be close to what's going on, but not complete. And what goes along with that and having a safe space is that when males who don't know how to network and work with a group of other males, the thinking behind that is those males may not have survived. Every once in a while, you need a few small percent of what they call sigma males that go outside and, lone wolf type. So you need those folks to go out and explore the unbounded systems. But for the but for those who don't, they need to have other males to network. So my first thought was that due to your leadership and the connections you've made with the black males, that they may have found a place where they can network in a safe space and express themselves differently than they may express themselves outside of that group. Is that something that resonates with you? Does that seem like something that's going on?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, please continue.
No. Please, you continue. Please continue. I'll get back there.
So what I was thinking about is that there's some assumptions about men, and there's some narratives that have been shared, whether they're shared and replicated due to misunderstanding or ill intent. That may not be the case, but the thinking behind things in general of what a true alpha male is and why it's difficult for men to express themselves and why they need safe spaces. So the thinking behind things is that women, they say, and I'm not saying that women don't know what they're talking about, but the conversation stems along the line of, yeah, I know that this guy here is a safe guy, but I like the bad boy, right?
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
The bad boy, the narrative, right? And so a lot of black men, based on Richard Majors, they do that cool pose, right? And cool, I'm cool, they're dealing with, the
right.
bad boy, because it seems to resonate with women. But as a thought experiment, to think about this for except a second, If you think about it, the bad boy isn't really the alpha male, right? Now, I know it's shared and is mediated that it's shared, but let's think about this for a second. The man, if we go back a couple hundred thousand years ago when we were primates, the male of the primate that goes out, or let's say the male human that goes out and mates with a woman, the male human that goes out and mates with a different woman every day, let's say 30-day span. That male that goes out and mates with a different woman every day for 30 days has a 1 in 30 chance of every woman hitting their ovulation cycle, right? So the thinking, you like the guy that's bad, that has a whole bunch of women, that's not the guy who reproduced. The guy who reproduced is the guy that had sex, mated with the same woman every day for 30 days because he had 100% of chance of catching the ovulation. You get where I'm going at?
Yes, sir.
So, yeah,
yes, sir.
So what we think about as a bad guy, that's not the guy that reproduced. The guy who actually reproduced is the one that stayed around with the same woman for at least 30 days. But if we extend that if you stayed around when their child was born, if it was a female child, the man did stay around, or in this case, the male that didn't stay around, that didn't protect the wife or his mate when they had a child, didn't have a family that survived. It's actually the family guy is the alpha male, not the one that goes around dilly-dallies, right? So whether that's your predilection or not, that's something to think about. The man who had a family and stayed around and protected his daughter from other knucklehead males and other predators, right? That the one who stayed around and protected his daughters had made sure and ensured that their daughters had good, solid mates. The male that stayed around when it had sons who taught their men, their sons, to how to hunt and how to be successful and how to build a fort and a house and make fire, that one had more sons that survived longer, right? So the narrative and the thinking behind the alpha male is not the family guy, that's not true. What has changed is that if we look at the way things have happened based on feminization of poverty, and that's been associated to women may be able to get money from the government if there's not a man in the home, and there's all these things that, you know, keep men out of the house. That has given us the idea that, oh, well, the alpha male is the guy that makes X amount of dollars a year, $100,000 a year, X, Y, and Z. But that has only existed for, like, the last, what, 50, 60 years. This has never happened before. When women are carrying a child and after they give birth, they're out for at least 3 weeks, right? They're not, you know, we don't have that type of, we don't have that system anymore where there was an actual physical need for men to be around present to protect their family, protect the children. We shifted that narrative, right? And so if, so going back to what does this have to do with the men, being able to, one, network and work together, that's the only way we survived, right? And being able to find safe spaces. So what may be happening is men are starting to realize that there are opportunities where they can network with other males, have shared spaces where they can, quote, unquote, be emotional, because what is what they're being told is not to be who they really are, that they're supposed to be a caricature of what it means to be a man, and may not necessarily being connected to what's really good. So, for example, there is a lot of thought behind men may be more likely to want physical touch. And since they are not supposed to be in a space where they can go to their woman and say physical touch is important, not just sex, but other things, hugs and stuff. How many times have we seen black women actually hug black men, and not even get into the conversation about the conversations that they say about black men, right? May not be able to get a sister to smile at you, but you more likely, definitely, are less likely to have a sister to just give you a hug.
I wanted to get that in, and yes, I did put the cart before the horse, and I apologize for him. But as I said, I'm at work today, so I wanted to get at least one question in before it got too late and we got the rambling and some other stuff going on. Family, this is Dr. Theodore Ransall. Where are you at now? Where are you currently teaching?
I am in Lansing, Michigan.
Are you at the University of Michigan, or are you at Michigan State?
I'm at Michigan State University.
Oh, man.
I heard there was another university here in Michigan.
Are you serious right now?
I don't know about
that.
Because, you know, the only one that's important is Michigan State. So there may be another one, but no one really talks about it.
Gangrene. Okay, I got you. That's what's now, the connection to us, obviously, you know, Rodney Smith is the center of the matrix, so he knows everybody and everything. You all met.
Definition of an alpha male, A, and B, an alpha male that knows how to network.
Absolutely. So you all met some years ago, and then he introduced us in person finally, because he's told me about you several times. I think in June, I believe, when I was in Vegas last. Well, I told Rodney I'll be in Vegas again next weekend. So I know I missed you because you were out there for the holidays. And I promise you, brother, people think that we're the same person because we can never occupy the same place, same space at the same time. So it's starting to get real funny out there. I'm telling you, like, who is? I thought that was no, that wasn't me. He's the better looking one. I'm the ugly one. But yeah. So
well, I don't know if everybody would agree with that, but please continue.
I really have been itching to get you on the show to have this conversation because your work is with young men. And we tend to get a bad rap, as you said. So the point of all of this is just to have that conversation. Like, you know, where what can we do to repair some of that ill will? What can we do to push back against those false narratives of that we're not there when, you know, we tend to be there more so than not? What can we do to amongst ourselves to help heal ourselves from some of the traumas that we've been through? You know, we as a people have been through a whole lot, and not to take anything away from my sisters, but, you know, brothers out here, like you said, sir, we need a hug too. Sometimes we just want to sit in silence and just be in your presence. And really, that's it. There's nothing more to it. You know, that is, in that moment, the most expressive we can be. And, yes, we may not be as forthwith with our emotional intelligence, assuming that we have any, but that's a different story. But we have feelings, too. And I really just wanted to have that type of dialogue, knowing that this is up your alley, if you will.
Well, thank you for that. So for those who have just joined us, you know, I've been on the show a couple times before. So my name is Theodore Ransaw. It is Dr. Ransaw, but you can just call me Ransaw or Ted. I just, because I'm from, you know, Vegas, so I'm not trying to blow myself up. I just want folks to know that I do have a PhD. Doesn't mean that I think that I know everything. My point being is that if you're asking, this is my research area. I work with black males. So how I got into research with black males, I had a mentorship program. I have four mentorship programs at three at-risk schools in Las Vegas while I was working on my PhD. And after my PhD, I got hired at Michigan State for the Black Male Achievement Gap Specialist for the state of Michigan. So that was my day job when I first got hired. So only reason I'm bringing that is I want to make sure everyone knows my background. So my research area is number one, I look at what fathers do to help their kids get ahead in school. The second one, I look at black males and education outcomes. And the third, I look at identity as a reader. Those things are all interrelated. And so we can always come back to that another time. I just want folks to know my background. And so it's research-based as well as personal experience. So with regards to personal experience, and you're talking about emotion and what do we do to change the narrative, I, as a black male, for whatever reason, I kind of feel that, you know, I'm happy sometimes. I'm usually in a good mood. But I am pretty much only animated, and that's the word that I use because it's accurate. I'm pretty much only animated when I'm around my daughters. I have way more emotions around my daughter than any other times, my daughters any other time in my entire life. I don't even think I felt emotions till they came along, right? And so why that's important is that being able to have emotions and deal with emotions was a new thing for me because my emotions amped up on a different rate. So you probably have all seen YouTube videos and all these things. So when a daddy's girl, and my daughter's a daddy, even my cat is a daddy's girl. But when I'm in the room, you know, I don't really pay any attention to anything else other than what's going on. I notice their facial expressions, their emotions, their body language. I'm thinking, my God, my daughter is so beautiful. Who's that boy trying to talk to my girl? Where's my shotgun? Hey, baby, you want to play with a toy? Like, all of those emotions are going on all at the same time. And I think that's reflective for a lot of men, right? So the narrative that men don't have emotions, for me personally, and I'll speak to you, is that I haven't really had emotions and stuff comes along, right? So I'll be brief because I know you said we need to pay attention to time. So with regards to emotions and change the narrative, there was someone that I went out with when I was a young man. I think I was still a freshman in college. And the short version of the story, I played football and I played sports all the way through high school, El Dorado, the best high school in Las Vegas. And what I remember I was on the field sometimes.
You give a shout out.
Look over my yes.
You give a shout out to your high school. You give a shout out to Vegas. I mean, come on, Doc. Concentrate here.
Well, that's what we do. So I'm on the field playing ball. You know, it's cold. I look over my shoulder. I see these guys on the stands. They got these girls. You know, they sitting on the stands, and the girls got their legs wrapped around them. I was like, oh, okay, whatever. So I'm playing the game. You know, I'm beating up, getting beat up, attacking, you know, representing my school. And I actually wind up having a relationship with the woman went to the games. And so what I didn't know is that the women put their legs over the guy's shoulders, right, and there's heat behind the guy's neck that keeps him warm. And so she was explaining this to me, and I was like, what? Because I had never experienced that. And so when people talk about peace, right, and what they want from a woman, it's not saying that they want the woman to be quiet. So we're trying to change this narrative. And she, you know, I'm always busy. I'm trying to do school. I'm trying to do music, running here and there, trying to do stuff. And she says, you need to sit down and be still and take a nap with me. I said, take a nap. I got more stuff to do. So she fought with me for days. And so one day, she basically wrestled because she was a dancer. She had real strong legs. She wrapped her legs around my shoulders and my neck, and she put my head in that position.
That's what happened.
I had never had peace. I had never felt that warmth. I fell asleep. I was out for 2 hours. I woke up. I was like, oh, my God, I feel so much better. Damn, I got to get back to work. She goes, no, it had only been 15 minutes. Never had peace that was generated by the energy from a woman. And I'll give one quick story because I know we're in time, but this isn't really important. So while I was a freshman in college, my girlfriend, her best friend's mother came to visit, and I was talking about this great new class that I had in African American Studies at UNLV, Black Power, Black People, the Black Panthers, and my girlfriend's mother's best friend was there, and she said, I used to type notes with Stokely Carmichael. I said, what? She was like, yeah, she was from Oakland. She was there. She knew Stokely. I was like, you... So I grabbed her arm and we sat and we went to this diner. And I said, well, tell me about the Black Panthers. There's two things she said that changed my life. The first thing she said, the reason why she joined the Black Panthers and why other black women joined the Panthers is because Stokely Carmichael was fine. So when we hear all these narratives about the Black Panthers, where have we ever heard? We've lost that conversation about black love. There was black love, and if you think about the translation for the support to President Obama, there was a need to have a black man who could stand up and be competent. So that competence, right, Stokely Carmichael, that love for black males, that's what helped and held the Black Panther Party together for as long as they did. She said the second reason why she was in the Black Panther and why she stayed in the Black Panthers, she said that for the first time in her life, she felt safe around white men. So we want the peace, right? Not wanting women to be quiet and not have a voice, where we could have a spot where we can relax and be in union and have physical touch with a black woman, that black love, one. But two, how many times can black women say that they feel safe in spaces where we are?
So, Dr. Ransaw, I'm expecting the phone lines to start ringing off the hook in about 10 seconds after you said that. And the reason why I'm saying this is because the narrative of the strong black woman is so different from what people actually say that it is. Just like when we talk of the alpha male, as you described it today, might be different than how it's portrayed in public. And if you can you sort of take away some of the mythology of both of those outlooks on the strong black woman, what a strong black woman really is from your perspective and research, but also what a strong black male is?
Wow, that's a lot of pressure. Well, I would argue to say that the strong black male is a man who is competent and who's responsible. So it's not so the idea, like, we've mismatched what it means to be an alpha male, and consequently it's mismatched what it means to be a black man. So there's a thinking that the big strong alpha, you know, don't mean to make connections between animals, but the primates, and the primates is the big strong alpha male is the biggest strongest one. That's never the case, right? Usually the biggest strongest man in the room usually works for someone else. But we have this thing that is the biggest and strongest, that is the alpha male. It's not. In primates, the alpha male that doesn't know how to network and doesn't know how to be supportive and doesn't help support his tribe, right? He doesn't help ameliorate arguments between the other primates and the women, and making sure that the youth are being taken care of and get food. That person who doesn't go out and get the nice, soft grass and gives it to the older males that were leaders before him so they could have a nice place to sleep when they retire, then the young guys that come up try and take them out. And two can take out one. So if there's more than two, you can imagine what could happen. So what happens when squabble starts, those old primates come around that he's taken care of. And so when stuff comes up, they just come up and they just stand behind him. They don't even say anything. They just look and say, y'all young folks, y'all can't take this one out. And they realize they're outnumbered. If you can't network and help mentor the young guys that are coming to you, and you can show value because of your age and your wisdom, they will take you out. Right, so you need to be able to mentor, not control, but to have growth. You need to support the other ones so they have, right? So all of those things play a role into what it's the competence about in all domains. It's not just you're the biggest and strongest. You have to be big and strong, yes, but you have to know how to, when to be kind, when to be assertive. It's well-rounded. It's all of these domains. And the thinking that it's only one, right, it's the Tyrone. Well, the Tyrone isn't the alpha male all the time. You know, how that translates to, if it was always the biggest, strongest male, it would be Shaq. However, here's another thought. Shaq actually went to college, right? I've met Shaq on several occasions. He goes to Vegas all the time. That doesn't mean anything. Shaq is very intelligent. So he is intellectually, believe it or not, Shaq is an alpha male, but it doesn't come across. People look at him being big and small. Y'all forget that he graduated from college and he's got businesses. Right? So what we think of as the alpha male is the biggest, strongest, not just strength. It's all of those domains. And we switch over to thought behind what it means to be, you know, black woman, right? Mm-hmm. If we think about not too long ago, just a few years ago, women.
Dr. Renshaw. My name is Varshia. I call into this show quite often. I did want to I did want to mention, though, that you mentioned two really powerful things. One you broke down was an African proverb, and it was the village that does not embrace the youth will eventually be burned down by those very people. You know, if you don't find something for the young people to do within the confines of the social fabric, they just will destroy it and start again with what they think is important. And it may
well,
or may
not
look.
That's what they should do in that case.
And the second thing I wanted to mention was Shaq himself. Even though you've proclaimed him alpha, he has himself mentioned that he was emotionally He was abusive, economically, financially abusive to his wife, and that she was 100% justified in severing their relationship the way it was, and that he has more respect for her now that she has been remarried and has found her true happiness. He loves her more now because he can't do to that woman what he did to the woman he has.
Thank you for sharing that. I get the impression there's something else that you'd like to share.
Oh, no, sir. I just wanted to make sure before you moved on to your critique of the, you know, of your idea of what, you know, a strong or good woman is, that the examples you used, you know, could have be more rooted in a little bit more basis, even though you got to, Shaq may not be, well, he's doing his work, okay? He's out there. We're all doing our work. When you are done with your critique, do you mind, I might be shifting us into your book, which I have found to be quite interesting, about teaching techniques among the population that Lee was asking you about earlier, the younger males, maybe even younger than, what did you say, Lee, 21?
Yeah, 25 to
a little bit younger than that.
Yeah.
I think your book is about talking to people a little younger than that, I believe. So let me be quiet and get this doctoral critique.
Well, just to share from you, I really don't necessarily want women to be quiet. I would prefer that they have a voice, but I'll be brief on this last point. If we look at, I don't want to get into the specifics, but that movie Hidden Figures, if we look at that movie, my experience with women and black women specifically is different because I come from that dynamic. So the movie Hidden Figures is actually one of the characters in the movie, not one of the actresses, but one of the characters in that movie I'm actually related to, right? So when we look at Hidden Figures, my family comes from the family of women that are educated, who are still women, you know, still wear dresses, that are still feminine, have degrees, but they still are wives. Not saying that you can't be both, but that's my family dynamic, and the men in my family were in the military. That's the generation that I came from. So I'm used to intelligent women that are smart, that have a voice, that are like way wicked smart, but their smartness is not just in their job capability and how they achieve and their degrees, but it's the way that they still keep the family together. But if we flash forward to today, when women think of an alpha male, they hardly ever think of a man that's in the military. They don't think of a man that's a teacher. You can't be more alpha male than be a black man in the inner city school teaching, teaching UFO. That's alpha male. You can argue all this other stuff. You can't be more alpha male than a Marine or a guy in the Air Force or any branch of the service, but that doesn't come up because if you're a teacher and you're black male, you don't make enough money. Or if you're in the Air Force, unless you're an officer, you don't make enough money, right? So we wouldn't have the family structure that created the support system for a woman to create NASA today if we didn't have that happen in the past. But we don't have that now. So who is the next person that's going to be supported by their family that's going to do amazing things, right? So I wanted to share that narrative, share that perspective, that is something that I see as what is an idyllic woman. Not necessarily that you have to have degrees, but putting the family in a place that's integral and not placing anything else but family first. I think that's really important. I think that there's other values other than a man bringing specifically cash, you know, to the table. You wanted to switch to another conversation. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yes, sir.
I'm sorry. I don't mind going there at all. But a couple of things I got to get off my chest.
Okay.
As black men, what can we do to help these young folks realize that they need one another?
I think the most important thing to help solidify the idea that they need one another is that black men, it would be really helpful if they were, one, in schools more. I'm a big proponent for more men in schools, but two, be more accessible and be let in to be fathers around children. And so the first one, more black males in schools. Here's something that I didn't see happening when I did my mentorship program in Las Vegas. I had 3 male mentorship programs and I had 1 girls of color. I didn't see in the research, it didn't dawn on me, I didn't realize that there was going to be a young girl that wanted to hang out with me all day. It's not that she had a crush on me or anything like that. She was just used to hanging out with her dad. She was a daddy's girl. So I show up. I have all female mentors. She would come sit by me, and I'm like, why this? And I was like, oh, we don't have a space for young girls who are daddy's girls in school because there's not enough men in schools, right? So how much are we losing? So for those of you who may not have been in school for a while, if a man shows up on a school campus wearing a suit, whole school changes. Whose dad is that? What's going on? Is somebody in trouble? Who? Kids, first, second grade, run out the class, grab your leg, won't let you go. You got to do the wooden leg walk around the class. You got to pick the kids up, right? That is where we're at. But we don't have that in schools, right? There's all types of work, you know, there's all types of things coming up for men in schools, and I get that. But for men to show up in schools and support their children. And that does two things. One, they become visible, and you become visible, you become accessible, and it helps you be important. And so once they realize that you have value, right, then they realize that, oh, you know, we kind of need each other, right? Not just necessarily need each other as like, you know, in the classroom, but it starts from the home, recognizing that, hey, having someone who's got your back in all cases, right, is important. So I think that's really important, right? I also, we talked about it's important that men are competent as much as they can in all the areas. And once you have competence and you have value, then teachers are more likely to invite you in the classroom to come in and read a book. Guys read books completely different than women, right? Fathers read books. They pick up the kids, spin them around. They put the bath sheet, you know, bath sheet around the neck. You know, they're playing Superman. It doesn't necessarily mean that guys are better at reading to the children than mothers. But dads, when they read to children, they're using masculine terms. And so what that means is men ask more abstract questions to their kids. They say, so what do you mean by that? Nope, slow down, control your breathing, start from the beginning. What happened, right? You know, sorry, men ask more specific questions. I got that backwards. Men ask more specific questions. Women ask more emotive questions. So guys are asking those abstract questions so kids can help their thinking. Women more emotive questions. How do you feel, right? And so you need both. And by not having access and being around to men where you have a balance of both, you're missing either the left brain or the right brain. You need a balance between both of those to be a whole person. You need both sides, right? And so that's something else that will show and will eventually translate to men being allowed to show that they have value, allowed to participate, and the last aspect being allowed in to have relationships with their children regardless of the relationship with the mother. Until those things happen, I don't think we'll be able to heal.
I want to say this before I get to Rodney's question, because Rodney did, he asked a lot of great questions, but one specifically that I'm going to hang on to. And you said women ask the abstract question of how do you feel. Do they ever stop asking that question? But anyhow, Rodney asked the question of, has the definition of a black man been changed in black society in modern times compared to historically? How was historically identified?
You know, I'm not really sure how to answer that question, and not being evasive, right? But the stereotype of the black man has been he's not intelligent and physical. Now, has much of that changed? No. The black man who stands up for himself and says, this is wrong, I'm gonna kneel at the flag, you know, that's unacceptable. You know, he can't, quote-unquote, stand up for himself by kneeling down, right? However, you can have a whole bunch of folks, you know, take a Confederate flag and raise that at the Capitol, right? And it's not viewed the same way. So I really don't know if the narrative of or the perspective or the false conversations of black males has really changed that much since it has been, you know, however many days ago. Have things gotten better? Well, I think things may have gotten a little bit better. But in general, I think overall, you know, for example, if you look at everywhere where there's a draft, there's a high predominance of black male players, right? And so I don't know how to square that circle, but I don't know how else to explain my thoughts on that.
I've been in the education field.
Go ahead, Roger.
I've been in the education field here, Dr. Ranshaw, about four years now. And I've just recently come up against something very odd to me, because I'm an old school parent where, not to say I didn't believe my children, but when an adult would tell me something happening, you know, in this sacred place of the classroom with my child, I wouldn't pretend like they were coming up with something out of nowhere. I would turn to my child and ask them, you know, how much of this is the truth, right? And have them be willing to admit their part of whatever this confrontation or conflict was. I've recently been in a situation where a parent was unwilling or unable to see her child's part in, you know, a conflict that ended up in me being on administrative leave. And when I look and see that you have a book out, nice one too, I love the art on the front, about techniques and principles that can be used when teaching and when educating young people. I wanted to know about your advice on, because I hear what you're saying about these black men in the room. When black men are in the classroom, it's a lot more controlled. Maybe it's the timbre of their voice. Some of them are kind of tall. But unless they're from a foreign country, I found that African male instructors in urban African-American settings do not do so well with our children. But in general, like old kind of hood adjacent black men who understand, you know, the socioeconomic status of the children that they're dealing with, they make a significant difference in the learning track of the children that they are standing in front of. So, yes, I'm down, but I can't become a man. So I want to know what can a black woman teacher do that almost embodies whatever black men teacher are able to broker out of a population of, you know, young urbanite children. Do you know what I'm talking about, Dr. Ranshaw?
I do. I just want to make sure that we're on the same page, literally. So you're talking about my latest book, Mindful Teaching Practice for Black Male Student Achievement?
Yes, sir, indeed.
Okay,
and if you can say that again, slower and louder, okay, because it's on Amazon, okay? Okay, Dr. Ranshaw?
It is. Thank you. So it's Mindful Teaching Practices for Black Male Student Achievement. It is available on Amazon, so that'll be, quote-unquote, the last plug. I just want to make sure that we're on the same page. I have a couple other books, so I want to make sure we're addressing that. So first of all, I want to share with you that, so I'm a third-generation teacher, and here's a story that my mother told me. She said that there was something going on in the lunchroom, called the parents. Parents come in, and they said, your son did X, Y, and Z. My son would never do that. they played the video of the kid on the table in the lunchroom dancing, showed the video, and the mom was like, so why weren't you paying more attention to my kid? Why would you let him dance on the table? Completely, like, had evidence. Couldn't have harder evidence, right? And so not blaming parents, but in this particular case, there's a blind side to that. You know, my kid, they're advocating for their kid. They may have had bad experiences in the school. They're trying to do whatever they can do to make sure their kid doesn't get kicked out, and so they're pushing the borders. So that's actually what parents should be doing. Not necessarily that's a good or a bad thing, but that's what should be going on. But how is this helpful? So what happens is teachers often, or schools often, seem to be the obstacles, barriers. They seem to be not on their side. So one of the things that came out of that's in the book, Mindful Teaching Practices, is from a colleague of mine here in Michigan. Her name is Teresa Saunders, and she has some other folks that she's worked with, but she has an African-American black male initiative. And out of her research that she's done and what she's initiated in Michigan schools, and by the way, Michigan schools, their reading scores and their educational outcomes are really close to ours, right? There's not very much difference, which is why I was, you know, sent there in the first place. So this is something that came out of her research. And so for those of you who are teachers, this is something that has been one of the most effective things, and it's called positive phone calls home. And so when you are in situations or to prevent situations, one of the things that can happen is if you have a black man in your classroom that you're having maybe not necessarily the success that you would like making connections, or you may not feel that his parents may not feel that you're on their side, that you may not be an ally. It's positive phone calls home. And so positive phone calls home works like this. You just pick up the phone, call, and say, hey, Mr. So-and-so, I just want to let you know that little Johnny had a really good day today. I just want to let you know he's doing fine. Hang up. What happens is mom comes home, she listens to that message. She's like, what? So when Johnny comes in, she's like, well, what did you do at school? He's like, nothing. And, well, your teacher said you did really good today. He goes, yeah, I was great at school today. Changes the whole narrative of the dynamic, because now little Johnny is like, wait a minute, I wasn't good in the class, but this teacher seems like she's standing up for me anyway, right? So that has been one of the most successful things that have changed the narrative in the classroom for the relationships with young black males, regardless if you're a woman or not, and as well as the relationship with the parents. So you do that a couple times. Now the third time's, hey, you know, I want to let you know little Johnny had a really good day, but, you know, perhaps maybe the next time you could talk to him, maybe he could just pay attention to lesson problem number five, a little bit more time on number five. Other than that, he's doing good. Now, little Johnny may not be doing well, but what happens is over a period of time, now the parents comes home and is like, okay, well, what is going on? It changes the whole dynamic, and it sounds simple, right? How can something that simple? Because what's happening is you're changing the paradigm, you're changing the dynamic of you being an obstacle, a barrier, and not being on their side. Now you're not just on, you know, the parent's side, you're on the teacher's side, right? And so that's one. That's a really strong, important. And then the other thing is when you get a chance, however you can, make sure that you include fathers in the conversations with their sons. A lot of men don't really want to get involved, but if you can catch a dad and say, hey, little Timmy, Tyrone, he's in class, he's trying his best. He keeps trying to talk to little Susie, and he's not getting his work done. Fathers go, what? Fathers handle that right away. If you can find a dad, not saying that men aren't around, but that is one thing that is research-based. That has been done here in Michigan that's been successful is positive phone calls home, and I hope that was helpful.
I mean, sort of, Dr. Renshaw, sort of. The issue really was that when they sit in front of a black woman, it's like sitting in front of their mama who's been nagging them, you know, for 10 years, 12 years, 15 years, 17 years, 18 years. And it's like we're Charlie Browned out. You know what I mean by that? The Charlie Brown's teacher. When we talk,
yes.
It's literally wah 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 wah. And because of that, that filter, it's kind of like a filter over their ears. We're only able to break through it in very real situational, and we have no control over when they'll pull the filter off. However, black men, it's something about an urgency, maybe because they're seen less, or they're tall, or their voices are deeper most of the time. It just seems like more serious business. And in doing so, the filter don't get put on as much. I'm interested personally in brokering the kind of educational respect from a young person that men just seem to be able to get with their actual presence. But I
don't know what you're saying. One of the things, one of the things that happened when I was
any thicker than it is, you know what I'm saying?
No, I know that one of the things why I got into working with black males is, you know, I started out as a sub, and they would say, "Oh, get Ransaw. He's good with those knucklehead black boys." And I show up, and this is my technique. I walk into class, and I would say, "Hey, man, sit down, let's start class." That was it. It was my gender. I had no classroom management. I didn't have any strategies. My biggest strategies is if the kids got too much out of hand, you know, when I was first or second grade, we go outside, run all day, and that was it. I didn't really have any classroom management. I didn't have any background in education when I started. So the reason why I say that is I recognize, and that's why I brought that up, when a man comes on campus, the class changes. So here's an idea. Right. What may help is if there was a black man, you know, that came into class, you know, maybe randomly, maybe there today, may not be there. Another one might be there the next day. After a while, you know, kids will be like, "Well, I don't know if there's going to be a guy in class, you know, in class today." So we mentioned that Lee has a relationship with some other black males. There's a couple of organizations in town. There's a couple of clubs. There's a couple of networks. Rodney knows a few. I have no doubt that between those two men, they could help find a couple guys that might come to your class, and they'll just come and just sit down. And then what they'll say, "Hey, you better listen to her." And one, just by being in the classroom is going to change. And if you respect, "Hey, wait a minute, what was that? Could you read that paragraph over again?" And then he could act like he's taking notes. Right, and now he's modeling the behavior that you would like to see in the classroom. Right, so that's not an end all be all, and it's not something specific that you can do yourself. This is something that you recognize is something that only happens when there's a male energy in the room. But I'm thinking if they come in under the guise of just coming in, and they're supporting you, and they can help get buy-in for you as their teacher, because here's a quote-unquote an authority figure that black male did respect saying, "Wow, read that paragraph again? Man, that was amazing. Where did you find that book?" Right? And small things like that that happen maybe a couple of times a week, you know, I think over a period of time, I think that will change the relationship that she has. And then two, you will be able to model what a positive relationship between a black man and a black woman looks like, because they may not have seen that before. And I think that'll be something that will have results.
Rodney had a question. Go ahead, Rodney.
Okay, Rodney is busy looking up a list of black males that he can find to come to class. That's what he's doing right now.
Now, that's what he's talking about. "I want to get in. I want to get in. I broke him in," and he's still quiet. Ain't that some stuff? But anyhow, I like that last point, because I think that is uber important. The fact that they may have never seen a positive relationship between a black man and a black woman. And that, we got to bring you back to talk about that just in general. Not that we don't have time today, but I don't think we have enough time and enough robust conversation to get into that as deep as I would like to dive. But you, he fell off. That's why. Okay, I got you. Like, no, you fell off. Don't be talking about I got you on mute. Go ahead, Rodney. I'm sorry.
No, actually, I was talking, but I was muted. So right. I had a bunch of questions, but some of them go too far back in the show. But one of those questions was, well, hold on. Let me share this so I can stay up to date with the show. Dr. Ransall talked about, and Rashi initially touched on it, about the voice, and I was typing it, but I was too slow typing it. I wanted Dr. Ransall, from his research as well as personal/professional experience in the classroom, to share the importance simply of a male voice and specifically of a black male voice in the classroom.
Wow, that's pretty powerful. You know, I'm going to say, for me in my house, you know, I had a dad around, and so I've never really respected like a male voice more than, you know, my grandmother's voice, my mom's voice, right? However, I think what happens is, and what research says more than anything else, is that classrooms are really geared towards, the term is called the feminization of education, but classrooms are really geared more towards girls than boys. And so what I mean by that, there's a common assumption that girls develop faster than boys, right? Girls develop faster than boys. Their language acquisition is, you know, all of these things. The girls do this faster than boys. But what actually happens is girls and boys develop differently at different times until right about the time they get to high school. They develop different things in different times. So girls develop fine motor skills first. Boys develop gross motor skills first. If classrooms were the type of environment...
Break that down, Doc. Break that down.
Yeah. If classrooms were the type of environment where when the bell rung, you got up out of the chair, you ran to the front of the class, you picked the biggest block that you could find, and you put that, and then you put those blocks in an ordered sequence based on something on the board, and it sat down the fastest. If that was the model of what it meant to be intelligent, then it would appear that girls don't develop as fast as boys. But since girls develop their gross motor skills sooner, then boys develop their gross motor skills, and they develop their gross motor skills later. They sit down and they color within the lines. Boys, over a period of time, the longer they sit, I think it's their serotonin levels decreases. So boys actually physically get fidgety because they are not biologically wired to be sitting still for very long. That's why boys need to go out and pee, right? Well, girls need to pee as well, right? And so, and to be fair, every time when I had my first and second grade class, when I was in charge of the PE, yeah, I had the girls running as much as the boys. I didn't, you know, I said I worked them hard. And most of the time, there's usually a couple girls faster than the boys, and I always found that entertaining. But anyway, going back to the perspectives, there's things that happen in the classroom that are more orientated towards girls, and that's the model of what we think. So why is it that if you sit still and you color within the lines and you raise your hand, why is that considered that that's the model of behavior as opposed to you don't want to sit still, right? How many people in the world have changed the world because they didn't stay in the lines, right? But you got to have, quote-unquote, classroom management. But to go along with that, what happens is fine motor skills, and that's continued as girls grow up. And then when, if you look at the military says that women make better pilots. Right, and so why do women make better pilots? They also make better marksmen because they have those fine motor skills, right? And so that's straight out of the armed forces, right? So girls and boys develop different things in different times, but the model is focused on one as opposed to the other. So when there's a man in the classroom, boys can feel that they can, quote unquote, be more and more male. If you're a guy in the classroom, you're the teacher, and one of the boys says, "Oh, I got the question." They stand up real quick. Oh, all right, good, James. Sit down. All right. Now tell me what it is. They're not, "James, why are you jumping out of your why do you share?" Like, a man in the classroom will recognize that behavior and not make the black male or any male in the class feel less than or reprimanded for them showing exuberance. If you go, oh, I know the answer, and you raise your hand first and the teacher never picks on you because they think that you're bouncing around too much, after the third or fourth day, you don't want to ask any questions at all because nobody's calling them, right? So having a male in the classroom, that helps ameliorate that.
Dr. Bradshaw, I'm a hit dog that's hollering. I myself have this, in the last 3 days, I have made 3 little black boys sit out because they could not, like as you just explained, they could not bring their behavior in line with what was happening with the rest of the class. And I did not and do not have skills enough to say, hey, you know, but what you just said, okay, hold on, calm down. Now, what did you just say? To not create a personal, they just can't. They can't not jump, pop up. They just cannot not pop up. It's not this. If that has nothing to do with you or nothing, they're engaged and interested in the information, and their body and brain behaves in unison. So when they're excited, they just pop up and say, I know. And that's just how it's going to be. You know, even if you try to tell them that's not how we do it, that is, you have to find a way to work that into. As a new young female, you know, black woman teacher, that has been one of the hardest things to incorporate into a lesson plan, you know, to pop up.
Don't be too hard on yourself. I appreciate you having the self-reflection to be able to say that. So I think you're way ahead of most teachers. So not meaning to cut you off, but I want to make sure that I address this because it's really important because it may help some other folks. There's a couple of ways that you can work with that. I read in something research, and it's research-based. I can't remember where I found it, but there's a teacher that she has a special hall pass, and when boys are misbehaving in the class, she gives them this hall pass. Boys can take this hall pass. She had a conversation with the principal. That means the boy can go outside and run around the building as much as they want and then come back in the class, no penalty, right? And that has decreased all types of stuff, right? I was like, now that's amazing, because how many times do you remember as a kid you just wanted to go outside and run, right? And then you can't, right? So that's one. Another thing that may be helpful is if you have more boys and girls in class, then you can have boys work in groups, and you can do something along the lines of, okay, all right, we're going to put these 3 boys together, and these 3 boys together, or however you break it down, and say, have them work in groups, because boys tend to like to work in groups, right? That goes back to that networking thing. And he said, whichever group finishes their math homework first gets to elect one person to shoot the ball in the net. And at the end of the week, whichever group has the most points can get a pizza party, or they can have recess for an extra 20 minutes or whatever motivational thing. And then that way there's excitement, there's exuberance, right? They can work in teams, but then they can also know at some point in time they can get some type of exercise. So those are 2 things that have been very helpful. The last thought with regards to black males, and I wish this was mine, this came up from another colleague. People tell me that the best stuff comes from other folks. Well, this comes from Dr. Diane Jackson, who was doing work in cognition when cognition research was first getting started. She noticed stuff going on in the classroom, just like how you mentioned, and so she said, well, coaches can get black males to do almost whatever they want, and they're white, you know, and most of the things going on is white teachers with black males. So she asked her grandson, what is it about sports that you like? And this is what she said. The first one, black males like clearly defined instructions, clearly defined instructions, being part of a team, and I guess those are the 2 things. Clearly defined instructions,
and winning.
Part of a team. Well, your winning is also important, right? And so if you think about those, you know, clearly defined instructions, being treated fairly and being part of a team, that's what black males resonate with it. Any way you can work that into the classroom, right? That is what's going to have the most success. Now, you may be able to do that in groups or teams, but as long as you remember those things, right, clearly defined rules. James, these are the three rules we have on the board. Did you agree to these three things? Yes. Did you do these three things? No. All right, then, James, what should you do? All right, I'll go stand in the corner or whatever, how that works. But those things are overwhelmingly research-based that have shown success in the classroom.
Doc, can you get into that discipline thing again, or at least you broached it, because I see a similarity between basic teaching as far as the coach is concerned and military discipline. And what I put in the chat is when you're playing sports, you get your role defined, and once your role is defined, you get your duties associated with that role. The same thing with the military. Your role is defined, and then your duties are defined with that role. And when you get out of line, whether it's your drill instructor or your coach, there's usually consequences, whether it's drop and give me 10 or do some extra suicides. Can you speak on that dynamic in coaching and associated with teaching?
Sure, I can do that. I'm going to do it a slightly different way. So earlier, you talked about women are always asking, how do you feel? And so what's going on with that, and I'll make it connect. It may not sound like it's going to connect, but women are usually trying to understand what the feeling behind it, because to them, feeling is the motivation and feeling is the understanding.
They trying to trick
boys,
us. They know we don't know. They know we don't. They trying to trick us. They trying to make us think about feelings and stuff. You know, it don't make us feel good inside, like Major Payne.
Well,
we
that's
all
true.
Funny
but that's how they gather information. They're figuring out if they know how you feel, they can predict what you're going to do, and if they can predict what you're going to do, they can feel safer. Guys are kind of like, we want to know specifically what's going on. We like clearly defined rules. What's the plan? Who's the quarterback? Who's this? What am I playing? This? I go long, turn right, break, let's go. Boys are done. That's like all we need. That's most men, most of our lives. How do we get along? How do we show our feelings? We're like, we get together. Hey, man, come over and watch the game. They're watching the game. Commercial break. I broke up my wife. Oh, yeah. Game comes back on. Next commercial. What happened, right? It's totally different ways of communicating and seeing the world. But going back to what Rodney says about sports and discipline, since women are usually trying to make understanding and meaning from feelings, and that's what they generate, boys reject that because they say feeling is not facts. You're always worried about feelings. So why are you talking about feelings? I'm a boy. I'm trained not to put my feelings aside because I can't wake up in the morning as a father and go, you know what, I don't feel like going to work today. That doesn't happen. We're just not built like that. I don't feel pretty today. I don't like my hair, so I'm gonna call in sick. Or you're in a board meeting and everybody's looking at you to make decisions. You just can't say, you know what, I don't feel right. It's time for me to have a good cry. That's not how it works. So we like, do this, turn left, do right. And so when we're in the classroom and the teacher goes, well, I think you're kind of right. And so if you think of, no, you didn't give a very specific, concrete answer. That's what boys want. That's not what we get from teachers. So when we see something that happens in the classroom, we say, okay, well, that's not really the right answer, but I'll give it to you anyway. We get pissed off because you just told them that wasn't the right answer, but they got credit for it. Now boys completely turn off. They don't have any respect for anything that the teacher says, and it absolutely turns off. So there's very specific cognitive ways that we make meaning and make information. And so basic training, it's we like military stuff because, you know, if you do this, you do this, you do this, 9 times out of 10, you'll get promoted, right? Or you go to the next step, and that's what you have to do. In the classroom, it's like feelings, or maybe this is okay. Well, I might give you a pass. We don't find that structure being helpful. Now, I don't know how to fix that in the classroom, but just understanding those two perspectives, I think most folks kind of get it. But when you apply it to school and how Rodney talked about physical exercise, you go to coach, you come first in all your drills. you hustle, you do everything you're supposed to do, you know your plays, you're going to start, right? But when you go, well, yeah, I know you didn't really catch the ball, Johnny, but, you know, you almost did it, so we're going to let you play, like, the whole team fall apart. And that's one of the things that's reflective in the classroom. So hopefully that how Ronnie talks about the connection between military discipline and structure, how that applies to boys and why they thrive in that environment, because it's clearly defined rules. You know what to expect, right? And when that's not there, boys immediately don't find a structure, or they don't have a bounded system where they can thrive.
Brother Barry, were you wanting to get in? I know Lee is out there making things happen at the workplace. And while Brother Barry is making his way on, we have about 11 minutes left. So a quick story, a minute. We took a school, Jim Bridger, that was a poor performing school, used to even have race wars there. Brought a bunch of men from the Air Force Base into the school. The school is now a math and science magnet, and those men and Air Force members in general coming into the school, and I don't want to say taking over the school, but having a major presence in the school was one of the major influences of the school's behaviors and attendance changing. The men and the military concept, when I say military concept, what Dr. Rand saw is this is what you do, this is what you get when you do it. When you don't do it, this is also what you get. That pretty direct structure had a major influence on the boys' behavior, which is typically what identifies good schools and bad schools as we determine them today. And it changed the behavior of the boys. And it elevated the girls. And that's one of those anecdotal stories that I like to shoot out. I have no scientific data to go with it, but I do like to share that story.
That makes sense to me. I have a story I wanted to share with you, brother, and it was about the expectation of the instructor. We have a doctor here, Dr. Linwood Taheed, and he also is a research analyst like you have on your bio. But his work has also been done in education and the scores around, you know, and statistical analysis of child achievement grades and scores. But his had a lot to do with expectation based on the curriculum put out by the teacher, the pacing of the class and whatnot. And he compared, you know, that white, you know, the pacing of white teachers in comparison to the pacing and expectation of black teachers. And it just became apparent that white female instructors in urban settings just inherently expect less and then got less from those individuals. So after reading that information, it really rang a bell to me about the power of standing, you know, in front of these young minds. And I really want to thank you for championing the cause, because not many men can even look at their own children every day, let alone a classroom full of other people's children. You know, Dr. Ranshaw.
Well, I do see your point. I expect, and I think men can do a little bit better than that, but I do see your point.
Hey, Ted, can you share a little bit about Dr. Green's book and your work with him, his work on expectations?
Okay, so for those who may not know, Dr. Robert L. Green, he was one of the first black deans in Michigan, in Michigan State. He was the first black person to get a PhD in education psychology. I think it was like 62. But anyway, he took a leave of absence at Michigan State to work for Dr. King between like 63 and up until he passed away. So right now it's Dr. Green and Ambassador Young are the two last living folks that were around Dr. King. So Dr. Green's book, High Expectations, his perspective is that, and research-based, and he's one of the leading folks on high expectation, is that not necessarily from a teacher's perspective, but from a child's perspective, if you give children and you work with them based on high expectations, quote unquote, that they can, then you wind up getting better results. So if you set the bar a little bit higher than what you would normally think that you would do, there's usually better results. So Bogossi talks about that as the zone of proximal development. So for those who are talking about that, you who heard that, proximal development is where the student really is, you know, where it actually are, and you want to push on that. Dr. Green is saying maybe just push just a little bit higher than that, and that's what the whole research-based concept behind high expectations that, you know, teachers will, I mean, students will reach to that. One thing that I found interesting is in the classroom, no matter how often I came up with an assignment or an instruction that I thought might be a little bit too high, and I said, well, let me try it and see what's going to happen. Every time I've tried that, there's been at least a couple of students that met that and went higher. Not saying that you should push kids, students faster or higher than what they should be, but high expectations seems to have more positive results than, as she just shared, low expectations.
All right. We're coming down to the last few minutes of the show. Dr. Ransall, can you let people know how they can get a hold of you, some of your projects that you're working on, and when they may come out?
Wow. Okay. I wasn't expecting that question. Okay. So, everyone, I am Theodore Ransaw, R-A-N-S-A-W. If you type in Theodore Ransaw in Google, I come up on all types of things. My book is Mindful Teaching Practices. You can also Google that, and you will so I have a book, Mindful Teaching Practices. I have a consulting company called Mindful Teaching Practices. So you can put my name, and that pops up that way. You can also put Theodore Ransaw, Michigan State University, and I come up that way. And then my email address, my work email, is R-A-N-S-A-W, so Ransaw, T-H, the first two letters in Theodore, so Ransaw, T-H, at msu.edu, and you're welcome to email me anytime. One, you know, I'm still tied to Vegas, so I don't mind answering questions. And, you know, it is part of my job. Those are the things mostly in Michigan, but, you know, I'm really interested in supporting Las Vegas because, you know, that's where I live for most of my life. So feel free to contact me, and if I don't know the answer, I'm usually around enough other educators and professors where I'm usually within 3 to 4 folks of being able to find that information. So please feel free to drop me a line.
Doc, I want to thank you for coming on and helping to knock out some of these questions I've had forever. But again, it's not over, man. We need to bring you back again because we need to get into some other stuff and get to some healing when it comes to this man and woman relating things. We got to get this back on the rails for real for all of our daggone sakes. But I want to thank you for your time. It's early in the morning no matter where you are. So I thank you for that. And, you know, anytime I can get Rodney out of bed on time, it's a beautiful situation. I think you were more motivated than I today. So I appreciate that. Rashi, thank you for always calling into the show as frequently as you do. And family, for you all listening live or later, appreciate you all at your time. Welcome to 2023. If you see Matt Gaetz out there fighting somebody, you know, just get out the way and let him get his ass beat because, you know, the Republicans deserve it. Until next week, y'all, I'll be in Vegas, so we'll do this thing live. Until then, you all be good. You all be safe. We love you, and a damn thing you can do about it. Peace.